Coronavirus cases are rising again nationwide, and it's not just big cities that are struggling.
In the most recent spike that began sort of at the beginning of September, it's rural areas by and large that have been hit the hardest.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, October 28th, how hospitals are stretched thin from a third wave of the coronavirus. Plus, Minneapolis promised police reform in the wake of the killing of George Floyd, but concrete change has been harder to arrive at.
One council member said they were going to abolish our current Minneapolis police system. Another said this council is going to dismantle the police department. Another said our commitment is to end the city's toxic relationship with the Minneapolis Police Department.
Also, how incarcerated people are viewing this political moment in history and how workplace harassment can still take place even when you're working from home. But first, hospitals stretched thin, healthcare workers overwhelmed, and too few resources. Those were the stories dominating the headlines in the early months of the pandemic. And now, once again, that's what we're hearing from some hospitals and clinics across the country, with many others close behind. COVID-19 numbers are rising dramatically nationwide, with more than 20 states reporting cases at or close to record levels, translating into more people being hospitalized. I'm joined now by Frank LaVecchio, professor of emergency medicine at the University of Arizona, and Dan Goldberg, a healthcare reporter at Politico. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much for having me.
Frank, the last time we spoke, you were painting a picture of an overwhelmed hospital system in Arizona because of rising COVID cases. Where do things stand today?
Today in Arizona, we're at a much better spot. Our ICU cases are about 200 or so. During the peak, it was about 970. We were about 85% use at that time, and we've dropped substantially. We are seeing numbers going in the wrong direction, though, with positivity rates, admission rates. We are seeing good things, though. People are staying home. When people stay home, when they are sick, et cetera, and they get evaluated by electronic visits, et cetera, tends to be a little bit better for us because we don't see the burden in the hospital. But we are just at the beginning, and things are going to get worse.
Frank, what are some lessons that you've learned over the past 6 months in working with patients and with having this virus that you're applying today?
That's a great question. And what we've learned is there's not much we can do for it. We can talk about drugs. We can talk about supportive care. In the end, oxygen help. But if you don't need oxygen, there's not many reasons to keep you in the hospital. If you other sicknesses are in check, for example, your diabetes, your blood pressure, there's not much we can do for you. So we try to push people at home. People are getting pulse oximetry, even in an underserved hospital like mine. And if the levels drop, we're telling the patients to come back. Never, if somebody's saturation was under 90%, will we tell them to stay home. Now we're telling them go at 85, 86% oxygen content, something typically that was an automatic stay in the hospital. People tolerate low oxygen much more. You know, I think it's because they are able to breathe. We realize that the air moving out is not as big as a problem. Getting them oxygen is a little bit more of an issue, much different than things like pneumonia or other things that affect your brain that cause you to stop breathing as well. It's a new disease. We're learning new things every day.
I just want to make sure, in terms of PPE, ventilators, resources, are you all feeling like you have what you need? As you mentioned, should cases begin to peak even more in the state?
You know, when we're at our peak, we were hit pretty hard and nobody came in for other diseases. Right now, because surgeries are open and other patients are still trickling in, I think there could be a stress to the system. But as we sit today, we're in a great spot. Unfortunately, around the country, that's not the case, where, you know, you see places like Illinois where they're getting 31,000 new cases. You know, that's higher than any state in the country except for Texas, for example.
So, Dan, let's bring you in here, healthcare reporter for Politico. Give us a sense of how much of a rise we're seeing in hospitalizations around the country, to Frank's point.
Well, right now, there are over 44,000 patients in hospitals. And just to give you some perspective, at the beginning of the month, there were only about 30,000. So we're up about 33% in the last 4 weeks. This is the most number of people we've seen in hospitals since the summer surge that, you know, peaked in July, but was, you know, really started to come down at the end of August. So things are really bad around the country. And unlike in the spring, which was really focused in the Northeast, and the summer, which was really focused in the Southwest, this fall surge that we're seeing is much more uniform. It's pretty much everywhere. Utah, Texas, Idaho, the Dakotas, Wisconsin, they're all having capacity issues at their hospitals.
Dan, one of the big concerns back in the spring was hospitals having to make decisions about rationing care. Are you seeing that playing out differently now than it was in the spring? Or are hospitals still being forced to make difficult choices about who gets care? Sort of to Frank's point, not necessarily who gets care, but how much hospitalization time people have and need to have right now.
Unfortunately, yes. We are seeing that, you know, Utah has made that announcement that they have begun to start rationing care. And we should, you know, explain exactly what we mean by rationing care, because sometimes, you know, people get the sense that it means you're left out on the street. But there are tons of little decisions made along the way that amount to rationing care, even things like staying home when your levels are at 85 as opposed to what we would normally do and bring you into the hospital. In Idaho, for example, they have closed a pediatric unit to turn it into a COVID unit. Now, that unit wasn't necessarily full, but that means if there is a pediatric case that would have gone to that hospital, now they're being diverted somewhere else. You know, when a hospital closes its cardiac unit and turns it into a COVID unit, that's rationing care. And like I said, unfortunately, we are seeing more and more hospitals, especially in the Midwest and the Plain States, having to make decisions like that.
Frank, does that sound familiar?
Oh, absolutely. If you walk into a hospital today, as opposed to a year ago, it is much different. Areas that were never hospital beds are now COVID units, and pediatric places are moved all over to different spots of the hospital because this does not affect kids as much as it does adults. In other words, the kids might get sick, but not as severe as adults. So we're taking those hospital beds and using them as adult beds. Yeah, the hospital looks much different. We use outside before people walk in. We're lucky in California and Arizona because we have good weather where people can kind of wait outside, but not the appropriate waiting room that you would normally have.
And Frank, back in the spring when we spoke, you were asking people to wear masks, follow social distancing. Has the public listened?
Not in all states. If you look at the rates of people who wear masks, et cetera, it's much more prevalent in people that are over 60. Hand washing is much more prevalent. Social distancing and avoiding crowds is much more prevalent in those over 60. In those under 21, especially, you know, teens, et cetera, I don't want to say it's non-existent, but it does not go as well. They don't tend to get as sick, so they don't really see the disease as a problem. If you look at a state like Dakota, which for unclear reasons, they are the highest state of not wearing masks, their rate is 105 patients getting COVID-19 out of 100,000 people, whereas the rest of the country is about 10 per 100,000 or so on average.
Dan, when you hear what the numbers that Frank is pointing out here, we have talked about there is no federal mask mandate. We know that. States have incorporated some mask mandates, but then there are lots of fighting. There's lots of infighting between lots of lawsuits about who should and shouldn't wear a mask. Is that leading or is that sort of prompting some of this rise in cases, Dan, that we're seeing across the country? Just failure to comply with basic CDC guidelines?
Absolutely. And it's become a political thing. We all know that. But if you listen to very conservative governors, even the ones who resist mask mandates like Doug Burgum in North Dakota, they are strongly recommending that people wear masks. They have been begging people to wear masks for months. There is no one, no serious scientist, including those in the Trump administration like Deborah Birxer or CDC Director Robert Redfield, who will tell you that masks don't make a huge difference. In fact, the CDC estimates that it could save hundreds of thousands of lives. And there are a myriad of reasons why people don't do it. Again, some of it has become political. Like Frank said, some of it is because they're younger and don't think that they'll get the virus, or if they get the virus, it won't be that bad. The problem is people who get the virus tend to spread it, and often they spread it to people who are more vulnerable. And that's exactly why we're seeing hospital numbers go up, because people aren't wearing masks. And as the cold weather creeps across the country, more people are gathering indoors. The activities that used to take place outside at parks and things like that are now taking place inside, where the virus is prone to spread.
Dan, earlier in the pandemic, back in the spring, the tri-state area governors all cooperated in terms of, you know, setting limits and and lockdown requirements, et cetera. Are we seeing similar cooperation among states in different parts of the country, in terms of different regions coming together to say, okay, let's, you know, coordinate efforts here to contain the spread or not?
Not the way we saw early on in the pandemic. I think the virus in March and April was so new and so rampant that governors were more apt to work together to control the spread and really shut down large swaths of their economy. Given where we are 8 months into this, there's much less political will for those broad shutdowns. So it's not to say that governors aren't cooperating with each other where they can, where there's any backbiting or anything like that. It's just that there isn't that same kind of political will to move in unison. And I think governors have really learned, or at least now are much more in favor of more targeted approaches.
We're seeing some of those targeted approaches here, at least in the Northeast. We saw some, I mean, my neighborhood itself was one of the micro communities that was under quarantine for a couple of weeks because we had seen a spike in cases. Is that where you see the enforcement headed as we head into the colder months?
I think that's absolutely where we're headed. We see it in Newark. I saw Hoboken just across the river announce new restrictions. We're seeing that in Illinois, another big state, in California and Ohio. Governors are breaking their states up either into counties or, as Cuomo did, into sort of hot zones, or some are doing it by zip code. And I think that's probably the next phase. That's at least what people are going to try to do to try and stem the growth of the virus at this point.
Frank, just curious, there's been a lot of concern as cases begin to increase about the possibility of a twin-demic, which would be flu season and COVID-19 cases colliding. Are you concerned about that?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's a nightmare. If you come into the emergency department or your primary care doctor's office and say, I have a fever, cough, et cetera, I cannot tell the difference if it's influenza, you know, A and B, or if it's COVID. And people say, well, the loss of taste, et cetera, you know, that happens with the flu. Sure, not as prevalent as COVID-19, and you can't hang your hat on it. You could say, get a test. The influenza tests are borderline useless, the rapid ones, especially during flu season. We just kind of treat empirically that if we think you have it, it's flu season, we usually treat you for the flu. And for COVID-19, we know the tests are not that accurate. So I think a lot of people, unfortunately, are going to have to quarantine. They're going to come in with a fever. I'm going to say, you might have the flu, most likely have the flu, but I still have to tell you because your COVID-19 test, even if it's negative, I have to still tell you to quarantine or, you know, be away from people for at least 10 to 14 days. It's very, very unfortunate, difficult for us as clinicians, and we're going to be overwhelmed in the hospital with people. You know, and I think something that you brought up earlier is about masks, et cetera, and distancing and following stuff. I mean, don't do it for yourself. Just realize that much like Italy and other countries, about 10% of people that were admitted were hospital workers. And unfortunately, it's not so much doctors as it is nurses. I mean, nurses are in there. I might be in the room for 10 or 15 minutes, a nurse is in there for hours doing all things that people wouldn't even imagine doing, touching their secretions, sucking out secretions while they're on a ventilator, you know, sending their body fluids for testing, et cetera. And about 4% of them, you know, died. And it's pretty crazy. You know, you went into healthcare. You didn't go in to fight a war, but unfortunately, it's becoming somewhat of a war.
Our thoughts are with all of the healthcare workers as they battle this third wave. Thank you so much. Frank LoVecchio is a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Arizona. And Dan Goldberg is a healthcare reporter at Politico. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Early on in the pandemic, the country's hotspots were largely urban centers like New York, but now we're seeing a shift to less populated parts of the country. And in more rural communities, healthcare systems are being stretched to capacity, especially in states like Wisconsin, where the number of people hospitalized for COVID-19 has tripled in the past month. For more on this, we're joined now by Rob Mentzer, rural communities reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, tell us about the rates of COVID-19 in Wisconsin's rural communities. How is it that they've been spiking?
So it was, in fact, the case that in the first wave of the pandemic, Milwaukee and some of the state's urban areas were harder hit. And it started over the summer to see a lot more activity in rural counties. And then, you know, in the most recent spike that began sort of at the beginning of September, it's rural areas by and large that have been hit the hardest. So that includes parts of northern Wisconsin, central Wisconsin, as well as northeastern Wisconsin, the Fox Valley, which is more urbanized area. Those are among the hardest hit areas right now.
Today, we're really focusing in on hospitals and healthcare facilities. Are the facilities in rural communities in Wisconsin prepared? Do they have enough ICU beds? Do they have enough personal protective equipment, for example? Do they have enough ventilators?
Sure. So rural hospitals planned for this. And, you know, the planning did begin back in the very first wave of the pandemic. And so rural hospitals would make plans for to make sure they had PPE, they had surge plans for how they would increase bed space as needed. And those plans are now being put into effect. And there are areas, rural hospitals, that absolutely have been overwhelmed. The state overall right now is at about 85% capacity in hospitals, 88% capacity in ICUs. But of course, that is not evenly distributed. So there are hospitals near to me in central Wisconsin that are at 100% or higher and that are transferring patients out to other facilities. And of course, at the smallest rural hospitals, they often don't have an ICU. And so in those cases, they're not set up to deal with the worst off patients or the highest risk patients, and they have to transfer them to other facilities.
That requires resources, the transferring of patients. It also requires staff. Tell us a little bit about the resources. Do these hospitals have the financial resources to be able to transfer patients if they need to do that? And do they have enough staff to treat the patients who are there?
Rural hospitals had a hard time financially before the pandemic began. And this has been a strain on their facilities in all ways, in financially and staff and in every way, emotionally. You know, there have been a number of grants. I've spoken to rural hospitals that got loans through the federal relief act. There are other sort of more local grants and state funds that have gone to some of these rural facilities. So overall, you know, if you talk to people at rural hospitals, they will say that there are big structural problems, but that they are weathering the pandemic here in Wisconsin. The staffing issue is a serious one because as overall infections have increased, they've increased among healthcare workers too. Recently, the Aspirus Health System, this is a very large health system that covers a lot of Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, said that nearly 9,000 of their employees, that system-wide, had or were suspected of having COVID. And so that demonstrates the problem. There are real staffing issues in some of these places as employees are infected with the disease and can't work in some of these units.
One of the most interesting things is the fact that Governor Tony Evers, who's a Democrat, has been at odds with the Republican-led state legislature. There have been lawsuits even about whether or not Wisconsin residents should be forced to wear masks. I mean, how has that affected what you're seeing in rural communities in terms of the COVID-19 uptick?
Well, the issue is just extremely politicized. In Wisconsin, the governor is a Democrat. The legislature is controlled by Republicans, and they have been at odds on these issues from the beginning. The legislature did, in fact, sue the governor over the statewide mask mandate. More recently, the governor administration ordered a capacity limit for bars and restaurants and some other indoor spaces to 25% of their overall capacity. And that was immediately the subject of a lawsuit. It was suspended by a temporary injunction by a judge. Then it was put back in place and now it's back off. And so, I think you can imagine why these things don't have the same impact when they're sort of on and off and on and off, and it's perceived as a political issue. And so it just doesn't connect in the same way with the public. Meanwhile, the legislature has not met since April in Wisconsin and shows no indication that they will meet and to consider responses to the spike that we're having now.
Rob, another interesting development that's happened in the past 24 hours regarding the state of Wisconsin is that the Supreme Court decided not to extend the deadline for mail-in voting in the state. What has that meant for voters, particularly those in rural communities?
So absentee ballot requests just absolutely skyrocketed in Wisconsin. There have been about 1.8 million of those made. And that includes, that's all parts of the state. That includes rural communities, absolutely. It is now too late to mail your ballot back in and reliably be confident that it will be in time, given the latest Supreme Court ruling. So the advice from all parties and all sort of voting groups is that if people have an absentee ballot now, they should turn it in person. I did see just this morning data that said that of those 1.8 million requests, 1.5 million have been returned already, like are accounted for. That's a lot of absentee ballots that are in and counted for. And you can bet that political partisans and activists will be sweeping the state to work on those last 300,000 or so.
Rob Mentzer is a rural communities reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All this week, we've been watching how mail-in and early voting has been going across the country, and we're hearing from you.
This is Jerry from Leeburg, Oregon. Voting here in Oregon, where we've had vote by mail for over 20 years, was fantastic and super easy. I filled out my ballot sitting at my kitchen table with a mug of hot cider and my voter's pamphlet right there. And then the next day when I went to town, I dropped my ballot in the secure drop box, and that was it. I was done. No muss, no fuss, no long lines. Super easy. Every state should do it that way.
I've always voted in person, but mailed in my children's absentee ballots for them. And this year I got a thing in the mail showing what each person at my residence, what their voting record is. And I noticed that my kids' votes may not have counted because they had me signed outside of their ballot. And until this year, I didn't realize how important the outside signature on the ballot was. So I am exceptionally worried that votes aren't counting.
This is Stephen Trimble calling from Upper Providence, PA. We voted via absentee ballot in an official drop box. Our experience was incredibly easy. We filled out our ballots. My wife and I filled out our ballots, signed them correctly, put them in their secrecy envelope and then their outer envelope. And then we went to the drop box location, which was easily found.
Keep those calls coming and keep on voting. Call us with your experiences at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. In the days following George Floyd's killing by police, a majority of the members on the Minneapolis City Council boldly pledged to, quote, end policing as we know it and disband the city's police department. Fast forward 5 months, and that pledge has yet to translate into reality. After months of protests in Minneapolis and nationwide, sweeping structural change to the city's police department is essentially at a standstill. Here to discuss what happened in Minneapolis is Brant Williams, correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio. Brant, thanks for joining me.
I'm glad to be here.
So big promises after the killing of George Floyd by the Minneapolis City Council to essentially, and to use a phrase that we're using a lot, defund the police. What was the promise? Did they pledge to defund the police, abolish the police? What exactly were they trying to accomplish?
Well, Tanzania, as you mentioned, they used a lot of different terms to describe what they were planning to do. And I looked at a couple of quotes back from the day when they were out at the park making this pledge. One council member said they were going to abolish our current Minneapolis police system. Another said this council is going to dismantle the police department. Another said our commitment is to end the city's toxic relationship with the Minneapolis police department. So there were a lot of different ways that they said it. And it came off as there's going to be some major changes made. And so and a few days after that, the council went ahead and they drafted some language to put forward to the city's charter commission, which would have allowed the council to essentially eliminate MPD from the city's charter as a charter funded as a funded department, and create this new department called Community Safety and Violence Prevention. And that department would have been under the supervision of the city council, not the mayor, who is currently playing that role.
I think one of the big questions that comes up when we talk about criminal justice reform, particularly in this moment of the conversation around, quote, defunding the police, what exactly would the replacement body have done?
Well, it's a good question. The details were somewhat vague. This proposal would have allowed this new department to include a division which would have employed licensed peace officers. And so that meaning police officers, likely ones carrying guns. But it wasn't clear how many of those would be on this particular, be a part of this particular department. Where would they patrol? There was a director of this department who would have to have some type of community crime prevention experience, not necessarily a police chief. So there were all these different ideas of this new department that would be not like the typical armed police officer, police force that would go out and respond to everything. And the vagueness of that was one of the reasons why people had such a problem. Some people had such a problem accepting this new idea.
How far did it get before it essentially evaporated? Or has it evaporated?
The Charter Commission, which is this unelected body of 15 residents of the city, took up the amendment language in July. They held about a month's worth of meetings. They held some public hearings. They even debated some proposed changes that they would want to make to this amendment. But in August, they decided, you know, look, we need more information about this. There's not enough time to get this on the ballot. So we're going to ask for we're going to delay our decision until later this year. And basically that ran out the timeline on the deadline that they needed to meet in order to get it on this fall's ballot.
How is it being defined right now? And you sort of hinted earlier that that was part of the confusion and why this really didn't take off in Minneapolis.
Right. When people hear the term defund, it could mean different things to different people. The council has basically, and this is something that they've started doing not just this year, but in past years as well. They will reallocate some funds from the Minneapolis Police Department's budget to other non-law enforcement crime prevention programs, such as in the city's Office of Violence Prevention. They've been undertaking this public health approach to violence prevention. And so the council has, during the budget process, reallocated just over $1 million from the police department's budget to the Office of Violence Prevention to create all kinds of different programs, including funding a group of so-called violence interrupters that would be out on the streets. These are non-armed, non-law enforcement people who would go out and try to inject themselves in situations that could turn violent. So they've been doing this type of process. And so that type of defunding seems to be pretty popular and non-controversial. But the idea of taking large blocks of money from the police budget, like there's a group there, they're demanding, you know, like take $40 or $50 million from the department's already $180 to $190 million budget and taking that out and moving it to various different parts of the city. And that has not had as much traction, at least as among city council members.
Brian, I'm wondering if you can help us take a national view here, the 30,000 foot view, if you will, about this. I've encountered a lot of antagonism, particularly on social media, for asking questions about how what the plan would be for violence prevention in the absence of a, you know, if in fact police departments are completely abolished. And I think that that's a fair question, but it appears to ruffle a lot of feathers, if you will, on the progressive, more progressive left. What does this tell us about the push to, quote unquote, defund the police nationally? We heard a lot about it over the summer, and then suddenly it seems to have died down a little bit.
In talking to a lot of folks here, I get the sense that due to, again, the pandemic, I think, is also playing a role in this. We're having to rethink a lot of how our institutions function. People are starting to wrap their heads around, like, maybe we can do all these things a lot differently than we've been doing them. And then following the killing of George Floyd, I've noticed a lot of people taking this seriously, that law enforcement can also undergo some major, major changes, including maybe not having armed police officers out there to respond to everything. Now, while there are some folks who say we can get rid of all police, as long as we've taken all that money and put them into the types of, you know, programs and housing and you name it, I mean, the argument is, look, people who have stable homes and environments and have their mental health and their faculties, they don't go out and commit these types of crimes that would require the intervention of an armed police officer. So you put all that money into those types of programs and you should be able to eliminate the need for that type of intervention from somebody who is carrying a firearm and has a license to kill people. Now, the debate here has been, yes, this can be done, but maybe not this year or in the next 5 years. And I don't think anybody on the Minneapolis City Council seriously thinks that this is something that's going to happen. Obviously, not going to happen overnight. But they're really pushing the idea, at least several of the council members, that, look, this is a future that we can imagine, we can envision this happening. And it's, as you know, it's going to take a while for people to share that same vision.
We'll be paying close attention to how it all pans out. Brant Williams is a correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio. Brant, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
With criminal justice reform an issue in this election, the voices of incarcerated people are as relevant as ever to the national conversation. But it's often a group that the media talks about, but rarely to. The Marshall Project is a nonpartisan, nonprofit news organization focused on the U.S. criminal justice system, and they've been doing just that by conducting surveys of thousands of incarcerated people about their political leanings and beliefs. Their most recent survey was of 2,400 incarcerated people, and it focused on how that population feels about proposed criminal justice reforms, including defunding the police. Joining me now to talk about these surveys is Nicole Lewis, a staff writer for the Marshall Project. Nicole, thanks for joining me.
Very nice to be with you again.
So we've been talking, we just wrapped a segment about efforts to defund the police in Minneapolis. What did your survey find about what incarcerated people thought about that issue? Or not specifically in Minneapolis, but just the more broader efforts to defund the police. And also, how was it defined?
Sure. So we took a pretty narrow definition. So we asked people what they thought about defunding the police, which meant taking some money away from the police departments and allocating that funding to services and to programs that could have prevented violence. And so what we found was that overall, many of the respondents were supportive of this. Many more Black respondents than white were in favor, but across the board, there was sort of broad support for this definition of defund.
One of the things that was that really stood out to me was that we rarely hear from people who are currently incarcerated. What was the goal in attempting to get these voices, thousands of people that you all have spoken to?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is a community that is often talked about on the campaign trail, talked about when we're thinking through policy, but we rarely hear directly from them. And so this was an opportunity for us to say, hey, something like defund, something like Black Lives Matter, as we're thinking through these policies, as we're reckoning with the way we think about crime, the way we deal with it, why don't we actually ask people who are potentially most impacted by the solutions that we come up with, and also who have like a direct experience and deeper insight into the kinds of situations, the kinds of circumstances that a person might find themselves in when they turn a corner and go down the wrong path, right? When a crime is committed, what was going on in their lives? And can they help us understand, if we can work backwards, what might have made a difference to prevent that crime from happening? And so I just think this was a real moment to get their voices and to get some of those ideas out from behind bars and in back into the general public while this conversation is going on nationally.
I think it's critical work that you all have done here. And I think often when we hear about political engagement around, for example, people who were formerly felons, who are attempting to vote, we've talked a lot about what's happening in the state of Florida. It's often people who have already left the criminal justice system. When we think about people who are currently in the criminal justice system, who are currently behind bars, there's sort of, I think, an assumption that there is not a lot of political engagement. You found what in your reporting?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, this survey is, I should say, the second survey that we conducted. And so in March, we actually released a broader survey that was 8,000 people, you know, between prison and jail. And we found a ton of political engagement, right? So this is a place, prisons and jails are a place where there still is some access to news, however limited. People do get, I should say, they are able to listen to the radio. So we found a ton of people who listed NPR as their main source, right? So they're still tapped in, they're still engaged. By and large, they're thinking a lot about how politics on the outside affect their families. They're also, for the first time, many people seeing very clearly the impact of decisions that have been made, of the representatives who are put in place, of the judges who've been voted in, of the prosecutors who are trying their case. And they're coming to a greater understanding of why, you know, representation matters, right? Because they're going through this system that is headed up by many elected officials. And so there's an increased understanding of, oh my goodness, this vote really, my vote really matters. It's really important that I pay attention. And for many people who may never see, who may never get out, right? For folks with longer sentences, we found, in fact, that prison had a politicizing effect, that they were even more engaged than people who'd come in and had been in jail or prison for just a few years. And a big part of that is that in order to get out, if they have any hope of seeing the real world again, that they're going to need to press for legislative solutions, right? So in many cases, the way that their sentence is tied up in statutes and laws, right? So they have a deep understanding of how this country works and where they can advocate for some, you know, hope of relief.
President Trump has made a big deal about how much he's done for criminal justice reform, specifically referencing his First Step Act. Did that resonate with the folks that you interviewed, that you talked to?
So we were really curious to see if there was any sort of interest or support for First Step Act behind bars. So we did ask people. And what we found was that, you know, this particular survey, 2,400 folks, you know, split between prison and jail, I should say specifically at the state level, right? So these are not folks incarcerated in federal prisons. And they said, oh, it's hard to tell, right? First Step Act, what difference did it make? And I think a lot of that is because this is a policy that only targets people held in federal prisons. And so the majority of our respondents were incarcerated at the state level. But, you know, you never know. Sometimes people, just the perception of being friendly towards incarcerated people, of wanting to make a difference, can have an impact. But we didn't see that in this case.
I'm wondering also, with so much attention focused on getting people who have already left the criminal justice system the right, reinstating their right to vote, whether or not you heard that people really want to have that right to vote in, even if they're behind bars.
Yeah, I'd say absolutely. You know, despite all of the many differences that we found in this survey, overwhelmingly respondents were clear that they felt that they should have the right to vote, wanted the right to vote. You know, this set expressed an aspirational sense of, if they had it, that they would use it. So,
and to be clear, people who are in jail can, in some instances, vote, correct?
That's right. So the majority of people, so part of this package, we released a story about efforts to enfranchise folks in jails. The majority of them are still eligible, not convicted, or they've been convicted of misdemeanors. But sheriffs, jail officials do not make it easy for those folks to have access to the ballot. So volunteers are really working overtime right now to try to make sure this population can vote.
It's a very important story, and we're glad that you all are talking to us about it. Nicole Lewis is a staff writer for the Marshall Project, reporting on voting rights, technology, and the privatization of services in prisons and jails. Nicole, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
The way we work has changed dramatically this year. Because of the pandemic, roughly 33% of us are now working from home. That's up from just 7% in 2019. And this shift to a virtual workplace has presented plenty of logistical challenges. It's also created a new environment for workplace harassment. Last week, New Yorker writer Jeffrey Toobin was suspended after exposing himself while masturbating on a Zoom call with coworkers, including some of our own colleagues here at New York Public Radio. Incidents like that raise questions about whether employers are prepared to protect their workers from harassment in digital spaces like Zoom and Slack. Joining me now is Sharon Vinnick, a partner at the Levy Vinnick Burrell Hyams Law Firm in Oakland, California. Sharon, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
The Jeffrey Toobin incident is relatively extreme when we think about examples of harassment, but what else can digital workplace harassment look like?
Well, since people are sitting in their home, we have all kinds of things that can happen. You can have a spouse who walks by without a shirt on. You can have items on someone's wall behind them or on their desk that would be inappropriate in the workspace. And then, of course, you have the extreme incidents like the Toobin incident that you just talked about.
Now, how much control, I mean, should someone be able to, or can someone have about those examples that you just laid out? For example, you know, if someone walks past the behind you on Zoom and they don't have a shirt on, is that the fault of the person who's on the call? Or is that just something that happens to happen because we're in this work from home world that's new to all of us?
That's the fault of the person who's on the call. The same type of laws and rules and regulations that apply in an actual workplace apply to the virtual workplace. And lots of companies already have policies that cover these sorts of issues.
And they apply to this new world that we're living in?
Yes, they do apply to this world that we're living in because you're still at work and you're still exposing your colleagues to the same type of conduct. Any conduct that would be illegal in the workplace is illegal in the remote workplace because the key here is it's still a workplace.
Now, in the case of Jeffrey Toobin, he says that he thought he had turned his camera off on that Zoom call. I wasn't there. But do excuses like that make it easier for people who are committing misconduct to sort of get off the hook?
Well, it certainly didn't make it easier for Toobin. He was suspended. If I was advising an employee, and keep in mind that I advise employees, not employers. If I was advising an employee, I would tell them that they could have a claim based on that, and I think employers would be quite concerned.
How would that work, though, Susan?
The way that it would work is that there would be a complaint made by somebody else that was on the call, there would be an investigation, and then there would be action taken in the same way that it would happen in the actual workplace.
So if something, how do people approach handling harassment and misconduct when it happens virtually? I mean, in a traditional office setting, you would make an appointment with your human resources representative to talk about this or talk to your boss in a closed door meeting, maybe. How do you do that now?
You would do exactly the same thing. Presumably, you would send an email or a Slack message, depending upon how you communicate, to either your boss or the HR person, and then you would make a complaint the same way you would do it if you were sitting in someone's office with the door closed.
From a legal standpoint, is it harder for a plaintiff to make their case when harassment is occurring online rather than in person?
I think in some cases it could be significantly easier to make a complaint. Depends upon the nature of the harassment. If it's an email or a Slack message, you actually have documentary evidence that it happened. If it's in a Zoom meeting where there are multiple people on the call, there would be witnesses to what happened. And that's very different than what often happens in the workplace setting where it's just one-on-one harassment. If it is just a meeting between you and the harasser, it would be exactly the same as if it happened in the physical office.
Now, we're talking often about some of the examples we gave are people in their own homes and what people, their colleagues might witness through their Zoom. But what about among colleagues on Zoom calls or in Slack? Like, how does harassment play out there? Like what happened with Jeffrey Toobin?
That would be exactly the same as if it were in the office. If you were, for example, in a meeting and you pulled out your penis, that would obviously not be appropriate. It's not appropriate to do it during a Zoom call either.
Wondering whether or not companies are updating their codes of conduct to include more specific language around things like Zoom and Slack.
Well, I've spoken with some of my colleagues on the defense side of the bar, and it really depends upon what the existing policy said. Most existing policies already talk about email and electronic communications, but certainly I would think in the last week companies would be quick to add Zoom and Slack as the ever-evolving landscape has indicated that people need to be reminded that that's the same as sitting in the office.
We are, of course, in unprecedented times, to use a word that we've been using an unprecedented amount of times, quite frankly. But We are also in the middle of an economic downturn. Lots of people have lost their jobs as a result of this pandemic. And I would imagine that people might, including one of our listeners who said that they sort of deal with this in the same way virtually that they dealt with it in the before times, says, you know, quote, same way as in person, laugh it off, hope it doesn't happen again. Are you hearing more people who are saying, you know, I think something weird happened, I don't really want to bring it up, I'm scared to lose my job?
You know, I've been practicing law for quite some time, and I think that these downtimes are just like any other downtimes. When somebody's been harassed, whether it's sexual or racial harassment, and they still have their job, they're generally reluctant to complain. Where they've been harassed and then they're terminated for some unrelated reason, or they're terminated because they complained about the harassment, they're more likely to go forward because finding a new job is very difficult.
Are there other ways that employers can be proactive about protecting employees from harassment in the work from home environment, where in some instances, sure, there may be other folks who are on that same Zoom call, but in other instances, it could be just a one-on-one interaction?
Well, I think that employers are probably going to make sure that they continue whatever legally mandated training there is. Here in California, we have all kinds of laws that require that people have semi-annual training. I think that employers are probably going to be proactive about reminding people that their obligations regarding non-harassment, no discrimination continue even if you're in a virtual setting.
And is there anything specific that people should be paying attention to about their own behavior?
Yeah, I think that when you're sitting at your desk, whether it's remote or actual, you should look around and see what's behind you, and that you should try to treat your home office the same way you treat your office in a building there that you get dressed up in fancy and go to work every single day.
Even if some people are working from their kitchen tables.
Correct. And lots of people are working from their kitchen table, but better to work from your kitchen table than sitting in your bed.
You heard it here from Sharon Vinnick, partner at Levy, Vinnick, Burrell and Hyams in Oakland, California. Sharon, thanks so much for joining with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's our show for today, everybody. Thanks, as always, for listening. Of course, you can continue to call us about things at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.